to the place where they are always together and always safe.
Tomorrow, Andre makes a decision as Sarah Kesselman continues to read The Betrayal by Helen Dunmore. It was abridged by Sally Marmion and the producer was Di Spears. Lee Hall's play, Spoonface Steinberg, had a remarkable impact when it was first broadcast over on Radio 4, and Hall went on to write Billy Elliot. It's a monologue from an autistic girl coming to terms with her life and terminal cancer, aided by her love of tragic operatic arias.
In the olden days, when you wrote the songs and the operas and that, it mattered how you died. When the singers singed and went about, and they sang like beautiful birds, and they fell over and everything. And she was all quavery and beautiful, and everyone holded their breath. And there she was, in the special light with her boobs and everything. And everyone would be looking, and they would cry, and in their hearts they would weep for the poor lady, the poor, poor lady who died so well.
You can hear Spoonface Steinberg this afternoon at 3.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, for us fans of Philip Larkin, a real treat this week on 4 Extra with a 40-year collection of his letters to Monica, spanning their relationship from 1946 when they met until Larkin's death in 85. They only came to light after Monica Jones died in 2001, and nearly 2,000 letters were discovered in his old house in Hull. The collection has been edited by Anthony Thwaite, who introduces this programme, and the reader is Hugh Bonneville.
Between December 1946 and April 1984, Philip Larkin wrote to Monica Jones more than 1,421 letters and 521 postcards, about 7,500 surviving pages altogether. It was to Monica that the dying Larkin entrusted the fate of his copious diaries. And indeed, soon after Larkin's death on the 2nd of December 1985, Monica handed over the diaries to his former secretary, Betty McAreth, who fed them into the shredder in the Bryn Mawr Jones Library, Hull. However, these many letters to Monica survive, and they chronicle his life and his attitudes more intimately than anything else we have. What I never could have guessed is the quantity of letters that emerged after Monica's death in 2001. In 1950, Philip Larkin moved from Leicester to Belfast to work as a librarian at the university. By this point, two of his novels had been published, Jill and A Girl in Winter. But Larkin had not yet published the book of poems that really established him, The Less Deceived.
First of October 1950, Queen's University, Belfast. My dear Monica, well, here I all too indubitably am, the first day in Ireland. This morning I came here by car to find Queen's Chambers is three large Dutch-fronted houses knocked into one. Question, you are pleased with your room? Answer, frankly, no. It is grossly underfurnished, the lampshade is made of brown paper, the bulbs are too weak, the noise from the trams tiresome, the sixpenny meter for heat will prove expensive, the students ubiquitous. Michael Innes speaks somewhere of the combination of refined luxury and barbarous discomfort that is the Oxford Don's life. It is the Belfast Don's life too, except for the refined luxury. I'm afraid you won't have had the distraction of novelty to take your mind off our parting. This will be meeting you on your return, and I hope it will take the edge off seeing your old colleagues again. I hope, too, your room doesn't look sad and lonely now my lethargic, cadging figure isn't in it. Truly, I shall always remember the fireplace and the cricket bin, and all the battery of things on the mantelpiece, Fifi and Blue Neddy and the flowered lamp. Your life there has come into extremely sharp focus for me now. Heating milk, singing in the kitchen, drying stockings, etc. You make it seem quite unusual and fascinating. I loved every time I visited you, and do want to thank you for being so kind, so gracious, and so generous. Work tomorrow, ha ha ha. Grow old along with me, the worst is yet to be. The adjective I should choose so far is drab. Goodbye, dear Taurus. Affectionately yours, Philip. 14th of October. Dear Sacred Cat, this afternoon I got my bicycle out again and cycled to Carrickfergus, about 11 miles up the side of Belfast Loch. The wind blew me there by 3:15 and I sat miserably on the esplanade. I ducked into a cafe with a coal fire and asked for egg and chips. No eggs, and sat reading your letter through again. When I'd finished, the sun was out and I pedalled back against the strong wind. The loch is wide and choppy, the hills on the landward side green and with sudden smoke-coloured shadows. The sky was full of changeable sunlit clouds, as it nearly always is. If England is a brewer's advert, Ireland is a railway poster. Just before White House, I found a peacock, yes, a live one, standing on the margin of the road, looking a bit disgusted with the 20th century. 21st of October. Dear White and Gold, I read W.H. Auden's collected poems recently. Not expecting to be impressed, I was impressed by the liveliness and the variety. How clever these people are. I also happened on a poem called Dublin by Louis MacNeice, and that also depressed me by its extraordinary talent. Despite all we say about them, Auden and MacNeice have talent, whereas the tiny fish have not. Poetry is like everything else. If you're not two-thirds of the way there already, it's not worth starting. Regarding literature, I was interested by your D.H. Lawrence remarks. I grow more and more unwilling to try to say anything about D.H.L. He is so enormous, so shifty, so deceptive, fascinating, and evanescent. Also, I get the odd feeling that I am inside him, staggering helplessly from aspect to aspect, and quite unable to see him as a whole, or objectively. He has always meant so much more to me than any other writer. I have adopted his conclusion so uncritically that half the time I have been living in a sort of interchanging dream where I am him and he is me. 1st of November. What news? Well, I wrote to two Belfast printers about my poems. One sent up a representative, the other said they only published commercially, but that A, B or C should do a good job for me. So there things rest for the moment. I shall have to type the whole thing out, first of all. A powerful deterrent is the shouting mediocrity of 43 of the pieces in question. Well, private publishing really is the end, of course. Humiliation's final dregs. And in New Writing 40, I find James Mickey, John Wayne, Alan Ross and Michael Hamburger merrily bashing away, and even Kingsley has got $25 out of Furioso for two poems. They tell me George Bernard Shaw is dead. I never see a paper. If I had a black tie, I'd wear it. He has given me much pleasure at odd times. A world without Shaw seems definitely a post-war one, doesn't it? 25th of November. Dearest Monica, the sun is still shining, yet I am left with a faint sense of dissatisfaction, hard to analyse. I had my hair cut and looked round the shops, buying a copy of Wild Bill Davison's Tishomingo Blues that so insinuatingly wound itself into all last summer. But a sense of having been rebuffed remains with me, perhaps because the cow in the record shop wouldn't let me, or didn't want to let me, look through a pile of Jazz Collector and Tempo records she had just unpacked. Cow of hell. I've never seen any before, and Belfast is the last place I expected to find them. I'm sure they will never sell them. Midnight, and I must lie down. Loving wishes, Philip. 28th of December, King's Head Hotel, Loughborough, Leicestershire. Dear skirted one, I did like your present, but you would have laughed at my expectations. As soon as I handled it, I thought, I know what this is. It's The Ordeal of Paul Cézanne by John Rewald. And a slight pang of apprehension went through me at the thought of the ordeal of Philip Larkin that would come from reading it. So fixed was this idea in my head that when I unwrapped it in the dining room on Christmas morning, my eyes yearned out on stalks. Wind? Wind in the what? Wind in the willows? And all the Salon des Refusés and Impasto and Degas and Le Chef d'Oeuvre rolled away like a bad dream, and I was safe with Ratty and Toad and all the rest of them. Animals all, as you quoted so very aptly. The illustrations are, of course, quite new to me. I don't quite like his idea of mole. Too hairy and rather reminiscent of Samuel Beckett's friend. But the others are delightful. Take care of yourself, great skirted grebe. Philip. 13th of January, 1951. Belfast. I think there were one or two misapprehensions of my last letter. Certainly I don't want to be bucked up with little talks on the duty of happiness. I was just saying that most of my miseries didn't deserve the solicitude you show for them. And my poem was really an attempt to capture my feeling on returning here. It's no sooner present than it turns to past. We think each one will heave to and unload all good into our lives, all we are owed for waiting so devoutly and so long, right to the last. We think each one will heave to and unload all good into our lives, all we are owed, for waiting so devoutly and so long. But we are wrong. Only one ship is seeking us. Black-sailed. Undistinguished-looking stuff, now I write it down in longhand. I suppose it is my equivalent of your dismay at finding yourself back. It certainly seems more final. The first term was a joke, but the second term isn't. I had a powerful sense of distance coming the second time. Before Christmas, I thought we might move the house here. Now, I don't know. It does seem a long way for Mother if I'm going to return to England in a few years. 12th of July. Dearest Monica, sorry about this paper. It was all I could buy at the Botanic Gardens post office. It really reminds me of painful letters written in large pencil script. Dear Mum, I got here in time for tea. Cook had taken up my bag and aired the bed. It's not a bad place so far. I have a room over the stables. Well, Orange Day, or whatever they call it, is nearly over, and no one can say I haven't done my duty by the North. Breakfast over, I took my bicycle out in light rain and pedalled slowly towards the village of Finnehy, where a huge procession eventually arrives from Belfast to form up on a field there and be addressed. Most people were straggling out in that direction, with headscarves and tottering children and lunch in a bag. In fact, it was rather like a scene for a modern Road to Calvary, with orange stalls and mineral waters and sudden overpowering stenches of vinegared chips. Much more thrilling was Sandy Row, the Protestant quarter, on Wednesday night. Bonfires at every street corner blazing up house high. I strolled down about 11:30, drizzle coming down as usual, and was fascinated by the cardboard arches across the streets, the thick waves of Guinness, warhorse tobacco and vinegared chips, the dancing crowds and the pairs and trios of gum-chewing young girls roaming about wearing paper hats stamped No Surrender, Not an Inch, and various unionist catchwords. Police stood uneasily about in their rain capes. Loving thoughts, keep ears up. Philip. 11th of August. Dearest M, this is the first letter I've ever tried to write in an aeroplane. Rain sweeps, driven by wind and propeller blast. Long wait to enable one to grow nervous. It really is a vile morning. And we are up, and not so smooth as I'd hoped. If this is going to be a rough passage, I shall be quite cross. Well, since seeing you born backwards into wet Exeter, I have had 4 nights in Swansea, and I don't know that I greatly added to my store of happiness. I met Kingsley's ex-mistress, a curious, dark, crooked-mouthed prognathic girl, whose scarlet cheeks and burnt cork eyebrows reminded me of Todd Slaughter made up for some villainy or other. Truly, one man's meat is another man's buttered parsnips. 12:45, crossing Irish coast, visibility good, churches surrounded by white specks, gravestones, much woolly drift, bumps. We are probably losing altitude now. Goodbye, till terra firma.
Tomorrow, Larkin advises Monica on her conversational style and meets E.M. Forster. Letters to Monica, read by Hugh Bonneville, was introduced by Anthony Thwaites, abridged by Miranda Davis, and produced by Lucy Collingwood.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
3 o'clock now, Wes Butters with award-winning drama next from the writer of Billy Elliot. Then Mel is back for the 4 o'clock show. Today she has the classic children's story, Emil and the Detectives. She's doffing her cap to the inventor of the humble bowler hat, earwigging on hairdressers' cutting comments, and learning about the history of the Roman postcard, all on the 4 o'clock show. So now, Spoonface Steinberg. It's a monologue and the last of a quartet of plays in a series all about growing up as seen from the perspective of children. After its first broadcast in 1997, the BBC received hundreds of letters and phone calls from listeners overwhelmed by what they'd heard. It was repeated almost immediately and sold thousands of cassette copies. Becky Simpson is Spoonface, 7 years old, autistic, very bright, and terminally ill.
God's Country by Lee Hall. Episode 4, Spoonface Steinberg.
In the olden days, when you wrote the songs in the operas and that, it mattered how you died. When the singers singed and went about, and they sang like beautiful birds, and they fell over and everything. And she was all quavery and beautiful, and everyone held their breath. And there she was, in the special light with her boobs and everything. And everyone would be looking, and they would cry, and in their hearts they would weep for the poor lady, the poor, poor lady who dies so well. And if I could ever grow up, I would be one of them sad singers and do the dying, and everybody would clap and cheer. And in all of the singing, when people heard it, they would have a little piece of beauty, which is very important, to have a little piece of beauty what's in the music. And this is what I realised. Even though the beautiful singing is sad, it is still happy in a way. The saddest things fill you up, like in a big way, and you feel so full, as in no happiness can bring such, and all such sadness is beautiful as the singing, as beautiful as the dying, and it would make a meaning. And I would sing the dying, and people would love me, and I would sing the dying, and out come the angels to take me away, and I would sing the dying, and there would be a lovely piece of beauty in the world. I would sing her dying and be as free as a little bird floating up to heaven. Never heard such sing before, except for when Dr. Bernstein brought the tapes. Even though the other children like such music as Take That and That, even one little girl has this tape of Take That, and Take That's into this picture, and they are all blowing her a kiss, and all she ever does is play the music. And she can't even hear because she's in a coma. and then take that made her a tape which said, "Hello, this is Robbie," and she still wasn't better. And I said this was no surprise on account of the tape. But I play the proper music, as it is so sad, and it is about the dying, and it makes me so clear. I was never right since I was born. This means that I do very bad writing, and that I can't speak proper, and that I'm backwards, and that I am a special child. But why is a mystery for what they have not got an answer. But Mam said, when I was born it was at a dark night, and it was raining and thundery, and all the cats and dogs and things were under the tables, and the wind was screeching round everywhere, and everything was quite horrible. But I didn't mind because I was just little, and I was in a hospital. And Mam kissed me, and when she looked at my face, she noticed that it was round. And everyone came and looked at my face, and they laughed and said I was spoon face, because when they looked at my face, it was round as a spoon. And when you look into a spoon, you see this face just like mine.